This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
It's a difficult shiur to give, and it's a difficult shiur to understand. But if you listen carefully, you'll understand it. If you don't, you won't. The theme that seems to come up over and over again during the first parts of this sedra is the theme we touched on last night, which is the power of the visual, the impact of the visual. Because if you look right from the beginning, the very first statement that Moshe makes to the Ribbono Shel is Hashem Elokim, you've begun to show your servant your greatness. Something new here is, not only do I know about your greatness, not only have I heard about your greatness, not only have I experienced it, but you've begun to reveal it to me visually, which enables me to say what I'm about to do, which is, Ebrana, let me go over the river, let me see that land. I want to see it with my own eyes. I know about it, I've read about it, I've learnt about it, you've told me about it. It's clear to me what it's all about, but I want to see it with my own eyes. And Hashem disagrees and says, you can't go over, but you can see. The Ribbono Shel Olam acknowledges the importance of seeing the land and says to him, Alei Rosh HaPisgah, you'll go up to the mountaintop, V'sayenech HaYama Tzvona V'temana Mizrachan, you'll look west and north and south and east, U'ra'ei Be'enecha, and you'll see with your eyes. But you won't cross the Jordan. And the Chazal tell us that miraculously he was able to see the whole land. Right? The whole thing he was able to see from that mountain. And we want to understand that miracle a little bit, because although it's a miracle, one has to understand how miracles work a little bit too. What happened? How can you see from there the whole land? The Red Sea is split. But we know how it happened. It's split with winds and currents and all sorts of things one can understand. That's one of the biggest miracles that's ever happened. Miracle of creation is a bit more difficult to understand. One has some kind of understanding how the various miracles happen, but what was the miracle here? What mechanism did the Ribbono Shel Olam use to introduce the miracle? Then he goes on. And he says, Einechem haro'ot et asher asah Hashem b'val po'ol. Be careful that you don't in any way detract or add to the Torah. Follow it meticulously, because you see what happened. You saw with your own eyes, and he stresses, Einechem haro'ot, your eyes saw what happened to the case of Baal Peor, which was people who didn't set out for Avodah Zorah. They set out to have a good time, and they landed up doing Avodah Zorah. These were all outstanding people who knew that it was not permitted to do Avodah Zorah, and who knew all the dinim, and who all said that, I'll be okay, I'll look after myself. And it didn't work. And he said, Einechem haro'ot, you saw with your own eyes the consequences. It's not just that you learned in the Torah, but you actually saw the consequences of not following the Torah meticulously, even where you believe it doesn't apply to you. Then, two sentences later, Ra'ei limadati etchem chukim u'mishpatim kasher tzivani Hashem Elokai. See how I've taught you the various chukim and mishpatim. Chukim are those mitzvahs of the Torah which are very difficult to understand the logic behind them, and mishpatim are the more logical ones. And he says, visually see those dinim that I've taught you. Don't just have it at the back of your mind that you've learned it. See me standing before you and teaching you. That's how you'll remember them. That's how you'll follow them. And then he says a strange thing. That this is your wonder, your wisdom, and your understanding in the eyes of the nations. Asher yishmu'un et kol ha'chukim ha'ele, who will hear about all these chukim, these difficult ones to understand logically. Va'amru na'ofrei rak am chacham v'navon ha'goy ha'gadol hazeh. This must be a very clever people. Difficult to understand. The goyim will see the mishpatim and they'll say, this is a wonderful people that I can understand. What wonderful laws we've done. And what are we heralded for in any case in the Western world? As the nation that brought monotheism to the world and that brought legal system to the world, etc., etc. But the chukim, korbonos, para aduma, shatnez, this isn't the kind of thing that the goyim appreciate. If the Torah says, if it's carried out properly, that's what will make the goyim understand that you're a special people. Difficult to understand, but we'll come back to it. Now there's a problem. before that, he says, "Raki shamer lecha," as we spoke last night, "v'shmor nafshecha me'od," be terribly, terribly careful. In case what? Pen tishkach, in case you forget something. What is it unforgivable to forget and intolerable to forget? Et advarim asher ro enecho, nothing that you've seen. Right, we learn from there that one isn't permitted to forget any divrei Torah. But Chazal, the Yerushalmi that I brought last night, learns from there the stress that is put on et advarim asher ro enecho, something you've seen, dare not be forgotten. And it's much easier to remember something you've seen, and as we discussed last night, the effect of visual impact. And we discussed last night further that in order to remember, you have to visualize what you learned. You know, in any memory course, one of the things they teach is if you want to remember a phone number, for example, is when you hear the phone number, to close your eyes and visualize it in figures of fire in front of you. So you close your eyes and see the fires burning. They've figured out and see that in front of you, and you won't forget it, they say, and it works. Once you've seen it visually, it's there to stay. If you haven't seen it visually, it's easy to forget. So we discussed the importance of visualizing your learning. When you've learned something, when you've grasped something, we discussed how important it is not just to let that be a fuzzy idea that you've heard, but to actually put it into some form which is you're able to look at standing off almost, you're able to look at objectively, you're able to see it in front of you. That makes it a lot easier to remember and to handle. There's a problem with that. The problem with that is spiritual and or intellectual idolatry. Spiritual idolatry is labeling God with a three-dimensional label. That's what spiritual idolatry is, to say this is what God is, or that is what God is, defining him. The whole discussion, you remember, with Moshe and God right in the beginning, where Moshe says to him, God sends Moshe to the people in Egypt, and he says, tell them that I've told you that the time has come to leave Egypt, etc., etc. What does Moshe say? Moshe says, the first thing these people are going to ask me is, what is your name? They're going to ask for some definition of this God. What is a God? And the Rabbanu Shalom answers, Ehyeh Asher Ehyeh, let them not worry about that. I will come to be for them what I will come to be. So the future depends, each one according to his own understanding of me. There's no way you can define me. And that's the essence of God's name, a nameless name. The concept of that he doesn't have a definition. To define the Ribbono Shel Olam, you're already, that's idolatry. To represent him as an object or as an individual, that's idolatry. The moment you confine the Ribbono Shel Olam to three dimensions, whether you do it conceptually or you do it in practice, that is idolatry. Intellectual idolatry is the same concept. That is that you might take an eternal, universal, beautiful idea, and out of a need to define it, you'll define it and kill it. So we do this in the Western world all the time. We can't handle something that can't be defined, because you can't calculate with something that can't be defined. You can only feel things that can't be defined. But you can't calculate with them, and since the left part of our brain is bigger than the right part of our brain, we like to define everything. And in defining, you miss them. That's it. That's why all this intellectual talk that we encounter over here, all the talk and talk and talk and philosophy is destructive. Not only is it not constructive, but it's very often destructive, because it reduces a concept to a definition, and it deprives you of any opportunity to relate to its essence afterwards. That's intellectual idolatry. And the problem with this that we discussed last night and in the Sedra this morning is the threat of intellectual or spiritual idolatry. If you have to visualize everything, and you do, in order to relate to a concept, you have to see that concept. In order to remember a telephone number, you have to see it in front of you. In order to remember a machlokes beis hillel and beis shammai, you have to see beis hillel, you have to see beis shammai, and you have to see the thing printed out in front of you, and you've got to see the argument, and it's all got to be clear. Doing that poses the threat of reducing something to a three-dimensional object, because that's what you see. Visible objects are three-dimensional objects. And there's the problem that any beautiful intellectual concept might be reduced. And in fact, it's what the Western people have done with their religion, with Christianity, with philosophy. And it's, to an extent, part of what the whole revolution was about, starting at the very beginning of the century and culminating in the hippie movement, an anti-definition with impressionistic art, to move away from clearly defined object still complying to the clearly defined rules of art, but not trying to picture something which is clearly defined, and that is a dog and that is a cat, rather trying to create in you the emotion you feel when you see that flower or you see that dog or when you see that cat without actually defining it. That's why it's a very exciting movement, and it shouldn't happen in Torah. That shouldn't be necessary, because at all times one should have both elements, yet that's incredibly difficult. Because if you try and do it the impressionist's way, then you're a balabos, as we've discussed in the Gemara often. If you constantly try and see your Gemara emotionally and psychologically and all this kind of thing, you'll never get anywhere in learning. You'll always be a balabos. So what do? You move into the technicality. You work out formulas. You work it mathematically. A thing has to be proved. It has to be counterproved. It has to be analyzed and reanalyzed. And then it has to be constructed. And you have to take one formula and another formula and throw them against each other and play them off against each other. And you develop a technical skill at learning. Then you come to intellectual idolatry and spiritual idolatry, where you've reduced your Gemara to a system of formula. So you move back to the Balabatish. This is the problem of learning. This is the problem of Yiddishkeit, in fact. To relate to Torah with a strictly formal, mathematical system of accuracy, and at the same time to have the feeling and the art relationship with Torah. That your lulav should be 100% a lulav according to all the detailed technical requirements of what constitutes a lulav. Right? That's giving it a name, that's giving it a vision, that's something that you can see in the sense of having it clearly defined. It subscribes to the scientific requirements of the definition of a lulav. But that can stifle your feeling for a lulav a lot. At the same time, one has to feel a lulav, one has to appreciate it, the beauty of the lulav, the spirituality of the lulav, the kedusha of the lulav. That's anti-science. And you've got constantly having to unite into one, science and anti-science. And so it is with tefillin and with Shabbos. Well, it's very easy to turn Shabbos into a miserable, depressing, restrictive day of do's and don'ts. It says the Rambam, that's still not Shabbos. Then comes the mitzvah of Tishbos. That's the most exciting part of Shabbos. When you're keeping all the formula, when you're keeping all the do's and don'ts, then comes Tishbos. Make it a Shabbos. That's drama. You're on the stage, you're acting. You've got to put something in, you've got to put your all in. It's singing, it's dancing, it's talking, it's smiling, it's moving. It's getting things going, it's creating an atmosphere within this rigid framework that you've established by following the strict requirements of halacha. And you can't move out of one area. If you don't subscribe to the strict requirements of halacha, you can't have a Shabbos. If you only subscribe to the strict requirements of halacha, you also can't have a Shabbos. It's difficult. But Moshe in this week's Sedra gives us the answer. And I can't even claim to understand it fully. So I'm afraid I'm going to be giving you only really a half a shiur, in the sense that I'm not going to get to the bottom of it yet, and I'm sure a lot of it isn't Kabbalah. Carrying on from the point where I've just left off, where Moshe says, be careful of one thing. Don't ever forget something you've seen. Don't forget that which you saw. What is it that he's referring to particularly? Yom asher amadata lifnei Hashem Elokecha b'choreiv. That day when you stood right in front of the Ribbono Shel Olam at Choreiv and you saw, don't forget that day. Because everything revolves around that day. That was the day when Hashem said to me, gather the people together and I'll tell them my words. I'll teach them to fear me all the days that they live on this world, them and their children. And you came and you stood underneath the mountain. Remember that mountain which the Ribbono Shel Olam held on top of you and said, if you accept the Torah, do you remember how you trembled? And Moshe builds it up and reminds them of the feelings they had at that moment. You remember that whole mountain was alight with fire. And it wasn't the grassy, it wasn't the felt fire. The sand and stones of the mountain were burning. Ad leiv ha-shamayim, until the hearts of the heavens. You know what a fire that must have been. The flames going right up as high as you could see. And they're standing very close. Imagine the heat and the fire, the fear that they must have had. Remember that, Moshe says. Choshech, hanan v'arafel, and yet despite that light, there was darkness, cloud, mist. It was hazy. It was mysterious. There was the strange combination of the clarity of the fire and the mysteriousness of the mist. Vayedaber Hashem aleichem mitoch ha'esh, and you remember God from the middle of this fire actually started talking to you. Kol dvarim atem shomim, the voice of words you heard. Utmuna einchem roim. That you saw no image. What's going on now? He builds up, don't forget all that you saw, and he reminds them at the end of this build up, you didn't see anything. Amazing. What did you see? Zulati kol. Accepting a voice. Literally, I suppose English translates that as saying, you didn't see anything, you only heard a voice. It's not the translation, how the English translated. It's not correct. It's you didn't see anything except a voice. All you saw was noise. Now what's happening? What's Moshe saying? You saw noise. You saw a voice. How does English translate it? Chapter Dalid, Posuk Yud Bet, at the end of Yud Bet. That's not a good translation. All right. And it's not so strange. I mean, it's not the first time I've noticed it, but that's just because my eyes have been closed when we read the Torah. Because in Yitro, that's why I was looking for that passage this morning. It says, in chapter Kaf, verse Tetvav, the Chol Ha'am, listen to this carefully, you read it, we say it every year on Rosh Hashanah, and the whole nation, Ro'im et ha'kolot, saw the voices. What's it? Ve'et ha'lapidin, and the torches, etc. Ve'et kol ha'shofar, and they saw the voice of the shofar. What's going on? We see that we haven't understood the whole concept of Ma'amad HaSinai, that's for sure. What went on there, up till now we've had absolutely no concept of. This is a brand new concept. Seeing voices. Of the five senses, two of them on the one hand and three of the on the other hand can be divided. On the one hand you have smell, touch and taste. The common denominator between smell, touch and taste is that your body has to come into direct contact with the thing you're sensing. Smelling, you're smelling an actual particle. It's not just a wave or something, it's an actual particle that comes into your nose. And taste, obviously, you have to be in direct contact with your tongue and your skin respectively. Sight and hearing are not like that. The power of sight and hearing is the ability to sense something which is distant from you and separate from you. It's a different category of sense altogether. There's a further difference. Shmio, to hear, or call, a voice, is the deepest knowledge you can have of another object. You can touch an object, so what's that? The way you feel when you touch it. Smell it. Taste it. Maybe that's also a deep one. But leaving those three on the sides, particularly looking at hearing and sight, seeing when you think of it as much confidence as we place in sight, it's a very weak method of judging the nature of the object you're looking at. In fact, you're not seeing the object at all. You're simply seeing light. And what you're seeing is the way the light reflects the object. Now, if you look at a radar screen, the thing that you're struck by is how impossible it is to detect from the spot on the radar screen what the object is. Why is that? It's understood because you're throwing a ray at it and it comes back, and if it dances back, there's a spot, and if it doesn't, there isn't. But what's sight? It's the same thing. Except your eye doesn't throw the ray, there's another source of light which throws the ray. And if it bounces back, there's an object there, if it doesn't, there isn't. And depending on how exactly it bounces back and what wavelength will determine the color of the object, and that tells you what the object's all about. Well, what does it tell you? It tells you nothing. Shmio, to hear a voice, that's different. In Kabbalah, there's a whole concept of dibur, of speaking, as being the revelation of the very inside of a person. And it really is that. When you're hearing a person speak, not only are you hearing a thought put into words, in other words, a potential, something which is a creation of the individual, being put into a way which is communicable, which you can understand, which in itself is a very great thing and very revealing, but the mere physical content of the voice is very internal. And that's why everybody's voice is so different. Nobody has the same voice. It comes from within yourself. It's your lungs, it's the shape of your body, it's the texture of your bones, it's your flesh, it's your vocal cords. It's all these things which are essentially you, which go into producing the mere physical nature of your voice, quite apart from the contents of what you're saying. so that when you hear a person speaking, it's coming right out of inside him you're hearing. That's why a person's voice is a very telling psychological indicator of who and what he is. Now, possibly if one knew how to interpret voice, it would be a lot more accurate than handwriting. Because the voice is really, it's the way he bears himself, it's the way he moves his lungs, it's the degree of self-confidence he has, it's the aesthetic ability, you can hear how musical he is, you can hear all sorts of things if you just concentrate on the physical qualities of the voice, never mind the contents of what he's saying. So to hear a call, to hear a voice is the deepest expression of an individual that you can possibly have contact with. And it's not only with an individual, it's with an object as well. If you flick a crystal glass and you hear the ping, it's not just because of the point at which you touched it. It's that whole glass that's resonating. It's the whole quality of the glass that you can tell by the quality of the sound. And when you press a key of a piano and you hear the quality of the sound too, it's not just the quality of the string that you're hearing. It's the string and the key and the wood and the tension and the thing that holds the string and the thing that holds the string on the other end. It's all these things put together that creates the voice of the sound, the sound of the piano note. It's the very inside of the piano that's talking out to you. It's the whole piano that's talking out to you. Whereas when you look at it, you can only see the outside at best, and even then, not the whole outside. When you listen to it, you hear the whole thing. It's inside and it's outside and it's top and it's bottom. Everything goes together to produce that little sound which you're hearing. And if you know how to interpret that sound, it tells you everything you need to know about the object producing the sound or about the individual producing the sound. Did you know that, Richard? Good. The sight is different. Sight is superficial. But sight has another mila. If you go outside and you see a fiddler on your roof, huh? Did that ever happen to you, Roy? On your roof, you saw a fiddler. They're doctors. You'll talk to him. You'll say, "Fiddler, what are you doing on my roof?" The first thing that will come into your mind is not that I'm seeing things. But if you're lying in bed and you start hearing a fiddler on your roof, you'll turn over the other side, you'll scratch yourself, you'll wake your wife and say, "Do you hear a fiddler on the roof?" The last thing you'll think of is that there's really a fiddler on the roof. Why is it? Because shmir, hearing, as deep as it is on the side of the giver, so in a sense superficial it is on the side of the receiver. It doesn't penetrate right inside you. You sometimes think you're hearing things and you sometimes do hear things. It's very subjective. Some people can't hear music at all, can't distinguish between notes, not like color blindness, which is a physiological difference. It's actually, you can be a very normal person and just not be able to enjoy music, not be able to distinguish the notes of music. It's very subjective. Some people like this kind of music, some people kind of that kind of music. You'll see two people sitting together, one will say it's noise, one will say it's music. Very subjective. It's all inside your head, really. Yeah, there are objective rules of harmony, but the actual experience of listening is an inner experience, and it's a very subjective experience. So when you want to check anything up, you look, you use your eyes, because the eyes are objectively a better sense. Furthermore, you see, you can't see something if there's a mechitza between you and the thing. That's the whole concept of mechitza in halacha as well. But from a visual point of view, a mechitza disenables you from seeing the object. You can hear a thing which has a mechitza between you and it. Not unless the mechitza is soundproof, which is a different thing altogether. But in other words, what I'm saying is you can hear something without being able to have any other contact with the source whatever. Whereas to see something, the source has to be uninterrupted between you and it. So that, again, ra'iyah, seeing, is a little bit more objective. It's a little bit more sure. If you see it, it's probably there. If you hear it, it's not necessarily there. Imagine what a combination it would be if one could theoretically combine these two things. See something as deep as sound. Imagine what you would have then. In other words, with a clarity of vision, you would be able to penetrate to the depths of sound. You know what you would know then? You'd be able to look right into the essence of everything. That's what happened at Har Sinai. they heard the call. They saw the call. The concept of idolatry is to turn a call into visual. And this is our problem all the time. We have to translate from one into the other. We live in a visual world and we live in an audio world. And we have to translate from one into the other. If you hear something and you want to understand it, we learned last night, you've got to make it visual in order to really see it clearly. So you have to translate it from something you heard into something visual. If you see something you want to intellectualize with, you have to translate it from something visual into something audio. That's the concept of conceptualization, which we discussed. And the opposite is the concept of visualization. So in order to manipulate intellectually, you have to conceptualize. And in order to clarify and understand after your manipulation, you have to visualize. But both visualization and conceptualization, I'm sorry to be using such big words that don't really mean very much, is a translation from the one frame of reference into the other frame of reference, or vice versa. What happened in Harsinai, or before Harsinai, idolatry is just that. To take the Ribbono Shel Olam, who cannot be seen, he can be heard. It's impossible to see the Ribbono Shel Olam. No one ever has and no one ever will. But lots of people have heard him. So the Ribbono Shel Olam, our relationship to the Ribbono Shel Olam is one that is governed on the audio level. We can hear him because he's all essence. He doesn't have a goof. He doesn't have anything that you can see. What can you see? Neshama you can't see. A nefesh you can't see. A voice you can't see. All you can see is the superficial outer shell, the body. The Ribbono Shel Olam doesn't have such a thing. That's why you can't see him. But hearing, that's the very essence of him. That you can. Idolatry is to translate the Ribbono Shel Olam's call into goof, into something which can be seen. That's idolatry, you missed the point. And intellectual idolatry is the same kind of concept in intellectual areas. The Zohar says on the Tzadi Beis of Bereshis, Let lach mila de let le kala. There is no object in the world that doesn't have a voice. Right? So voice is not just the superficial sense of the voice. Voice is the essence, as we've discussed the concept of the essence. When you ping that glass, everything has a little ping. It has its own unique sound, which is a revelation of its essence. And the Zohar goes on to a fantastic discussion there as to why you can't hear the music of the world. If everything has a sound, it should be an orchestra, continuously. So as it is, there are various things that get in the way of your being, other noises that stop you from hearing it. But by cancelling it out, what do they call that in physics? Where one sound wave blocks out another one. Interference, both by interference and by being a bigger noise than the others. So? Yeah. But we won't go into that. What happened at Har Sinai is that they saw the call. They saw the voice. They didn't translate it. And that's what Moshe is reminding them. Be careful of idolatry. That was not idolatry. This is the very essence of the Jewish experience. Seeing the call itself, seeing the essence itself without translating from one to the other. There is the most incredible Malbim in Shmot, chapter Lamed Aleph, verse Yud Chet, where the Malbim brings two Chazals to start with, and he explains the Chazals. The first Chazal says, I don't know where these Chazals are, but they shouldn't be too difficult to find. In the beginning, Moshe was learning and learning and forgetting. So don't feel bad if it's happening to you. Moshe Rabbeinu learning from the Ribbono Shel Olam as well, and makes me feel a lot better also. I don't feel such a rotten teacher. The Ribbono Shel Olam was battling with Moshe. Couldn't remember. It's Moshe as a Talmud and the Ribbono Shel Olam as a Rebbe. He couldn't wish for better than that, and it didn't work. Actually, b'sofa aboyim yom, until the end of the 40 days, nitan la Torah b'matana, the Ribbono Shel Olam gave it to him as a gift. Come and take it. And because it says, it goes on the words in the Torah, Vayitein el Moshe, Kichaloto ledaber ito b'Har Sinai. When he finished talking to him on Har Sinai, he gave him the Torah. As I'll say, talked and talked and it didn't work, so he gave him the Torah. Next one, the next Chazal. Chitilo haya Kadosh Baruch Hu hamedaber. in the beginning, the Ribbono Shelolam spoke and said, like Philip taught us, like Philip was teaching us the song. He spoke, and then Moshe followed afterwards. And at the end, Omar le Hashem, bo v'noimar ani ve'ata. Come, let's say it together. And the Malbim explains this. And he says the following theory. By the way, an incredible thing that he says en passant is he relates, developed a mother tongue and not used the mother tongue for a long time, and he won't have to relearn it. It's there, it might be dormant, it might be a bit rusty, but it's there, he doesn't have to relearn the language. Whereas if you or I would learn French now and not use it for 10 years and go back, we would virtually have to start in the beginning again and relearn. And really what the child does is this kind of concept. The child has a massive advantage over us. Because when we learn French, or put it this way, when I think of a chair is a concept to me. I don't think of a chair as a thing with four legs. I don't imagine this chair or that chair or any other chair. I don't imagine anything. I imagine a chair. In fact, it works the other way around. When I see that, I say that is a chair. In other words, my frame of reference is the concept chair. And I fit the object into my frame of reference, not the other way around. Where if you tell me this is a kisei, I say kisei, that is chair. Oh, that's, now I know what it is. Right? It's a slower process. It's a translation that's taking place. When a child learns, it really seems as if it's the other way around. When a child learns, you say, the child eventually picks up that this is the thing they're calling a table. And that's the thing they're calling a table, assuming these two look a little bit different. What he does, he doesn't start working out, that's a table, this is a table, which is a table. A concept is born in his mind, table. And this fits into that concept, and this fits into that concept, and he starts fitting things into the concept of table. And I'll off the mark. So far. If I am, they'll catch up with me eventually. And that theoretically could all happen at once. Now, a child is just intellectually not capable of it all happening at once, but the child doesn't develop, move out from that. In other words, when chair is a new thing. And it could be done simultaneously. The child could grasp at the same moment chair and table as two different concepts. Later on, the child starts building up. And that is a table, leg, without. Table without a leg, then they understand and they're starting to translate. Then it's already a translation process that's taking place. But the very primitive requirements of talking, the child develops the concept first and then fits the object into the concept. In any other language later on that one learns, one doesn't do that. You know the concept because you've known it since you were a kid. You've always known what a table is. Now you've got to know how do you say table in Hebrew or Arabic or French. Once you've known that, you label the table with the name, with the word. That was what Moshe Rabbeinu was doing in the beginning. He was new concepts, kedusha, tairo, all sorts of things that were being brought, and he was trying to fit them in to his language, to his conceptual system that he had achieved already. This is what I spoke about at the first year on Monday night, I think it was, about how one has to be careful, or the disadvantage at which a person is who comes into Yiddishkeit later in his life, is that he already has a system of values, and now he starts fitting in Yiddishkeit onto that system of values, and what he ends with is not Torah. He can be involved in Torah for the next 50 years, but if those first 15 years weren't Torah, it will never be Torah. It will always be Western culture with Torah attached. All what he's got to do is he has to basically uproot that tree. Not negatively, not by throwing out ideas. There's a special way that it has to be done. Rather by displacing it with new ideas. Slowly, branch by branch, displacing that old tree with new concepts. Then when he's finished, he's got a Torah tree that stands on a Torah foundation. That's why I said about our guys, that the commitment to Torah is wonderful, commitment to learning is wonderful, commitment to davening is wonderful, commitment to the Ribbono Shel Olam is wonderful, but we're not Jews. We're not B'nai Torah. We don't think like B'nai Torah. We don't dress like B'nai Torah. We don't talk like B'nai Torah. We're not B'nai Torah. Because we're just, here's something. So we try and test it in terms of what already exists. If it fits in, we accept it and we have this cockeyed tree building up. And if we don't accept it, we throw it out. And on what are we accepting it or rejecting it? On the basis of a culture which is not Torah. And there's no way that that can build up a Ben Torah. There's no way that that can build up a Jewish personality. What Moshe was doing, Lahavdil, was the same. He was trying to fit this godly conceptualization into his original understanding of things. And the Ribbono Shel Olam says, this isn't going to work. What you have to do is you have to rid yourself of all your physical attachments, so that you can enter my world and see my world like a child sees an adult's world. A child has to get out of the womb and has to get out of its own little world into the adult world before it can start understanding. And that's possibly the meaning of the Chazal, that the baby forgets its Torah as it comes out of the womb. Because it can't relate the world to the Torah, and it has nothing to stick to. We'll discuss that some other time. But when the child comes up, the child has to understand, when he hears an adult say table, he's got to understand that is a concept, a new concept, and then he must fit things into that concept. He mustn't make his own word for table and then try and fit an adult concept to it. And that's the danger of talking baby talk to a child. Because then this isn't a table, it becomes a tabley, or whatever it is, and the child then has to translate later, and table becomes a second language. It's not a first language. It's possible that's a problem. What happened further on? Here says the Malbim. Then there's another Chazal, one third Chazal. But basically what he says happened is that as the Ribbono Shel Olam spoke, the words in their letter form took the form of fiery letters in the air. As he said, Anochi, you just saw these letters. Aleph, Nun, Kaf, Yud, in fire, in flames against the black sky. Hashem, and you saw the letters Hashem, in fire, standing over there. And he says, that's what it means. There's a Chazal that says exactly that. But that's what it means, that they saw the voice. The Ribbono Shel Olam's voice actually took on a letter form, and they saw that. And you know what he says, how the tablets were made? Unbelievable. With Einstein's theory, E equals MC squared, that fire was converted into matter. And that became the tablets of stone. The fire became the whole, and the air around it was converted into hard matter, and that became the tablets. Imagine the sight. You just see Anochi into the air, Hashem, you don't know what's going to come next. You see these things forming one after the other. You hear the Ribbono Shel Olam saying it, and you see this fire, and at the end of it, it freezes there. And it cools down, freezes, and you're left with the tablets of stone. Imagine what that must have looked like. That was Matan Torah. That's what it was. And if you think that's strange, sorry, can I just have a finished Bereshit and throw it together? Since the Malbim lived before Einstein, on what did he base his theory? He based it on the Sikurna, the same Sikurna that Einstein based his theory on. Believe it or not. Says, at that point, he's describing what the word Tohu means. It says, in the world was Tohu Vavohu. He says, Haita davar murkav mechomer rishon hanikra Tohu. The whole world was made from a basic material, equal throughout. There were no distinctions, no different molecules or anything. There was one. That was Tohu. He could describe it a little bit further. Uvezeh hitba'er shachomer harishon davar mechudash. And that explains that only that chomer, only that first molecule, was new. That's what God made. He made Tohu. The rest, by playing with the molecules in different forms, he built up different things. But that was the thing that he created. Then he explains why the word Tohu is used. Oh, here is the reason. The nikra ha-chomer shel oto ha-merkav ha-rishon Tohu. Listen to this. And the reason for that, which that first element was called Tohu, Lihayot mitzad atzmo davar kochi bilvad, because in essence it was only energy, it wasn't matter. Bilti nimtzad wasn't physical, material, before, in actuality. And from that, he said, he converts that energy into matter. Sipurna. So the concept of the fire of the Aseres Hadibros forming themselves into something material, which one was able afterwards to have, is something which is the basis of Maaseh Bereishis. That's the way the whole world was created. That's the essence of physics. No big miracle. Right? I don't know whether scientists have ever done that, energy to matter.
That's fusion.
Is there such a thing? They haven't done that yet. So that's still a mess that only the Ribbono Shel Olam has done so far. See. And that's why there was no translation necessary. It's an Einsteinian theory. Translation is only necessary when energy and matter are seen as two separate things. And you've got to move from energy to matter, and from matter back to energy, from Re'io to Shmiya, and Shmiya back to Re'io. You see matter, that you hear energy. It's the lightning and the thunder, in a sense. What you see is fire. It's something that's really there. What you hear is the sound, is the spiritual essence of the lightning and thunder. That's why there's two different brachas for them, in fact. What happened at Har Sinai was that the voice itself, which is energy, spiritual energy, transformed itself into something visible, into something material, and that was the Luchos. This is something one has to try and achieve in everything one does. This is moving into spirituality, moving into Torah. When we talk about Talmud Torah, about learning Torah, what you want to do is you want to do a Moshe. That's the best you can possibly do. Doing a Moshe requires getting to this level where you don't have to translate from one to the other. Well, you don't, apart from the superficial aspect of what I discussed a little earlier, of translating Jewish concepts into Western understanding, quite apart from that, let's forget the whole Western understanding point of view, and you see a Tosfos. Now, what you can do is, okay, so you see the Tosfos, that's Re'iyah. So you understand the Tosfos, that's Shmiyah, you hear it, you've understood it. You now want to play with it. You now want to use it in argument. You want to understand it better. You want to apply it. In order to apply it, you have to convert it back to Re'iyah. So you define it. This, in essence, is what the Tosfos says. You make a definition, a formula, which you can then play with. That's fine. You finish playing with it. You want something which is clear again. You translate it back to understanding. That's the way we're dealing all the time. What ultimately has to be achieved is that you forget about all that. You climb right into the Tosfos. Forget about, just get in and feel the essence, be enveloped by the Tosfos itself. That's an incredible level to get to, but that's where one has to be aiming. What is the inherent, and this is the part that I say is not clearly enough understood, so I'm not going to spoil it by taking it any further as to exactly how to do it. We'll discuss it still. But I do understand an impediment to achieving that, because that's in the Malbim. The impediment is the same that Moshe had. Too attached to the world. That's it. As long as you're attached to this world, everything has to be translated into the left-hand side of the brain. Everything has to be made quantitative, it has to be made calculative, it has to be taken from a spiritual into a physical, it has to be taken from Shmiyah into the ear. Only if you leave this world can you combine them both. Only if you involve yourself in spirituality, which is the meeting point of the ear and Shmiyah, it's the meeting point of that, of the essence and the outside, of the clarity of vision with the depth of hearing. That's what spirituality is. But for that you have to get right out of this world a little bit. Like Moshe had to be 40 days up there before he got onto the level of understanding, and then Nitan Loga Matona, like a flash, he got the whole Torah. That's really the difference between inspiration and calculation. And you can calculate, but calculate is building blocks. You've got A and you've got B and you put them together, and you've got C and you take X and Y and you put them together, and you've got Z and you take C and Z and you put them together, and you've got P. And say you go on building. Very nice, but you won't come out with a brand new idea. And I told you about that professor's definition of a genius. Genius being the guy who can go out of the area of Re'iyah, of accepted terminology and accepted definition, and grasp something beyond that. That's Shmiyah. But without having to immediately translate it back into Re'iyah. Later on he does. He gives it a definition. When he's understood it, yes, then he brings it up. But that's inspiration to be able to get out of your little area, out of your little world, and grasp something brand new, for which you have to use your ear, your heart. Kohelet says, "V'libi ra'a chokhmah." My heart saw chokhmah. Something you've got to use your inside to grasp. And then, in order to use it later on, you can bring it down into this world and define it. And that's a very Kabbalistic concept as well. There is such a thing. That once a concept is brought down into the world, it's there. For example, I've told you that you have in many cases in Halacha and in Gemara, where the one case that I remember was in Yeshiva when we came and we were learning Gerudah, where the Taz comes with a brand new Chiddush. And he says, this is new, I know, nobody's ever said it before, but don't worry, I've checked it out with my Rabbeim, who all said also that it's brand new and original, but it's good, it's acceptable and understanding, therefore I write it down. You read the Shach across the page, same thing. They were contemporaries. Who got it first? They definitely didn't get it from one another. And it's brought in Kabbalah. Remember my Rebbe telling me then when we learnt that particular passage that once a concept has been brought into the world, it's available for anybody to conceive of. The genius is the first guy that brought it in. He's the one who jumped outside, heard it, translated it into the ear, and made it physical so that anybody could see it. Then you can calculate it. You don't have to be a genius to grasp it, even if you aren't actually told it. There is such a thing. And that's the concept of ruchnius dikah, living, of actually living in the spiritual world. To do that, one has to be a little bit divorced from this world. Now, but one has to be careful to understand what I mean divorced, and with this I end. How does I compare this whole thing to a rocket, to the problem of getting out of the grips of gravity. The average man is tied by the gravity of conventional definition. The genius is a man who's able to break that push of gravity, that pull of gravity. How does a rocket do it? That's how I started working out. And I worked out the rocket does it by pushing something out underneath him. Right? It explodes inside himself and pushes energy down to the world, and that pushes him out. If you're pulling from the world, a jet doesn't work like that. A jet takes in air and pushes out. A rocket, the chiddush of a rocket is that it doesn't take in anything, except it's petrol, but that's a different thing altogether. And it explodes inside it, and that energy which pushes it out. It doesn't take air and just push it out. To be taken from the world, you need the world. You're too much tied to the world. When you're in a situation of taking, you're in the hold of the thing. That's why the psukim, I don't remember the psukim offhand, Eved loyve l'ishmalve, a borrower is a slave to a lender. There are various such psukim in Tanakh that illustrate the avdus, the slavery of a man who's taken. The man who's giving is a master. He's a gavra. The difference between gavra and chetzos. The man who's giving is a gavra. To release yourself from this world, it doesn't mean you detach yourself from the world. That you can't do, because you'll die if you detach yourself from the world. To release yourself from the world, you've got to become a rocket. Only give, that's all. If you're only a giver to this world, you're not tied by this world, and you're free, in fact, to be a genius. You're free to conceive of new ideas in the spiritual area and bring them down. As long as you're tied to this world, you'll be insecure about leaving it. You'll be insecure about leaving your old ideas behind, because you're not independent enough. To be a genius, you have to be independent. Independent means I don't need anything around me. The only way you cannot leave things around you is if you're a giver. From morning till night, you're just a giver. If you're a receiver, you need things around you. If you need things around you, you can't throw them over in order to grasp your new definition. And that's what Moshe had to do. That's why it says he got the Torah after he didn't eat and sleep. Didn't have to take food from the world. Not even that. He was able to exist independently on the mountain. Then he could grasp the Torah. And that's ultimately where Limud has to be driving to. That's ultimately where learning Torah has to be driving to. So it's not something which is immediately within our grasp. But sometimes one just has to open the gates a little bit and see where we're going or where we're supposed to be going. Otherwise we just go in circles and we have no feeling of what it's all about. That is the chiddush of this week's Sedra, where Moshe warns Am Yisrael to be careful of idolatry, be careful of translating the Ribbono Shel Olam to material words, to material things, because you didn't see anything, Zulati Kol. All you saw, the only thing that was physicalized or materialized, was the very essence, that's Kol. And that's the only thing you should ever materialize, is the very essence, not anything but that. Yeah, so I forget to answer it at the end. Coming back to the land, that gives us some kind of understanding of how the Ribbono Shel Olam was going to enable him to see the whole land from the mountain. Because now we see that as E equals MC squared, so if I sound equals psi something squared, but it's interchangeable. And he could stand over there, and theoretically, if one could change the land into sound waves, and remember sound is something you can hear even when it's out of sight, and transmit it in sound waves, and then reconvert it into sight waves, there you would have it. I don't know, I was trying to work out whether that's done in the opposite is certainly done. Transmitting, taking sound waves and turning them into light waves and back into sound waves is a telephone. Television is what? This way, taking, no, it's not sound waves though. But it's all electromagnetic. You're not taking, yeah, it's the same kind of concept, but it's not the, except that he stresses there, the Ribbono Shel Olam stresses there, be'einecho, no television. You're going to see it with your own eyes. And Chazal say, that's to illustrate it without equipment. It's really you yourself who will be doing it. But at least we understand the concept and the continuity of the Sedra. But it starts with a concept of vision, and he says, I want to see the land. And the Ribbono Shel Olam says, yes, but not the normal way. You're going to see it a different way. And that the Moshe uses to introduce his whole sermon, this new type of vision. Remember, you've also had that new type of vision at Har Sinai, and that's the thing that can protect you from idolatry. Yeah. With this, I really finish. That is the back to the Chazon Ish that we did on Thursday night, rather the previous Monday night, where the Chazon Ish discusses the relationship between refinement and intellectual knowledge. It was a difficult Chazon Ish to understand, you remember, but now one understands it. What is the essence of refinement at the end? A giver, not a taker. A man who only gives, what is a man who embarrasses somebody else? I get covered because you lose covered. Any lack of midas is me getting at someone else's expense. Refined midas is someone else getting at nobody's expense. Remember the Chazon Ish's definition of a refined man. A man who always wants to give and is never hurt himself, never feels done out himself. That's the essence of refinement. You need that to achieve chokhmah. Without that refinement, you remain an eved to this world. You remain a slave to this world, a slave to its conventions and a slave to its definitions, and you can never enter the world of genius.